Final speaker on the program and the anchor man is Stephen Tonser, who needs no introduction to anyone. It's a cliche which really applies in this instance. He was in at the beginning of the Philadelphia Society. He's at the, as far as I'm concerned, at the beginning of modern conservatism. He is a great man with a great understanding of the subject matter today, as well as many other subjects. My pleasure to introduce Steve Tonser.
I feel, ladies and gentlemen, somewhat like Mr. Creedy in the Midas Muffler television ad. The engine of the old model of conservatism which I drive is still running well, and I believe that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I've come to view conservatism as a perennial political philosophy which does not admit of Neos or Saturn models. Moreover, my parents and grandparents belong to a generation which had difficulties with hyphenated names, and I am not about to retrace their steps. I became a conservative in 1954. Rather, I should say that I discovered I was a conservative in 1954. The event was not a conversion experience, but a moment of self-revelation and identification. It was not unlike the experience of a friend of mine, a Catholic, who one day, on entering a Catholic church, reached out his hand to dip it into the holy water font and said with sudden clarity of mind, "My God, what am I doing here?" He left the church and never returned. I dipped my hand in the holy water font of Russell Kirk, and I said, "Home at last." Whether or not one is a neoconservative is not simply a generational matter. It's not that I am an old party comrade and knew the 12 apostles, and those neos who came after us belong to a new and different age. After all, Irving Kristol must be nearly as old as I am. No, there are still young Big C conservatives who enter the movement every day and who are as far from neodom as I am. Nor is the great divide the consequence of changing times and altered political and economic circumstances. It is not that most neoconservatives think that Barry Goldwater is cute and ought to be honored and revered and humored now and then, but think that we ought to realize that he belongs to the Paleolithic age of conservatism and the conservative movement. If that indeed is the case, then I too am a paleoconservative, in contrast to the self-styled neoconservatives. It can't simply be that neoconservatives read and often write for Commentary magazine. I read Commentary and have done so for years. I find myself often in agreement, always stimulated, and now and then put off by Commentary. However, I don't think Commentary is a reliable test. It often publishes what I consider Big C conservatives. Age, changed circumstance, and an identifiable literary connection have little or nothing to do with the ideological identity of those on the right. There I've uttered that awful word, which is usually prefaced by far right. These differences which separate neoconservatives from conservatives are differences which have for nearly 100 years divided the right itself. I have made these personal references because I believe that the way in which I became a conservative, my starting point, was very different from the way in which one becomes a neoconservative. One's starting point and the way in which one achieves an identity has very important implications for what one becomes. These differences among conservatives, these differences in the right, are grounded in the relationship of conservatism to modernity. Increasingly, our culture is becoming aware that it is no longer modern, though it is totally uncertain just what it is. This cultural break with modernity presents us with the preconditions for an accurate assessment of our relationship to modernity. By modernity, I mean that revolutionary movement in culture, which derived from a belief in man's radical alienation, in God's unknowability or non-existence, and in man's capacity to transform or remake the conditions of his existence. The thoroughgoing secularism, the attack upon the past, religious and social, aristocratic or bourgeois, the utopian dream of alienation overcome and innocence restored, are all linked together in the modernist sensibility. To be up to date was for 100 years to be an alienated person. Indeed, authenticity was another word for alienation. The world was viewed as anarchic chaos upon which man, now become God, imposed his own particular dream of order. Often as not, that order of human invention was an inverted order, an au rebours, against the grain, against nature. Prometheanism and Satanism were one and the same order of man's invention. The romantic satanic hero is the same man as the Prometheus of Shelley and Marx, the Zarathustra of Nietzsche. To pretend that the conservative movement has been immune to modernity is self-delusion. On the whole, the right has been much more modernist than the left, because the right has dared to think consequentially, because the right knows that he who says A must also say B. It is for this reason that the modernists of the right have been, almost without exception, fascists and totalitarians, for they know that when things fall apart and the center does not hold, the only recourse is to an invented or an imposed order. Now that we're able to gain some perspective on the last century, we recognize that the social and political consequences of modernity is, in fact, totalitarianism. We can see that the denial of the existence of order as the ground of being and the rejection of the transcendent are a one-way street to Dachau. If everything is permitted and the will to power is the only reality, then the gulag is as logical as an Euler diagram. Those who do not refuse to think the unthinkable have known this for a long while. Hitler did not need to give a written command, no, not even a verbal command, for the final solution. Himmler and the members of the SS Einsatzgruppen knew the final solution was implicit in their conception of reality. It is on the ground of modernity that right and left are merged, and the differences between them are only differences of style and slogans. The right which is born of modernity is a radical, a revolutionary right, which cannot in any important degree be distinguished from the revolutionary left. Now it is a matter of fact that most of those who describe themselves as neoconservatives are or have been cultural modernists. They have been, to use Peter Berger's telling phrase, baptized in the fiery brook. Peter Berger was making an elegant pun on the name of Ludwig Feuerbach, the left Hegelian inspiration of Marx, and the church father of alienation theory. We conservatives have been baptized in the Jordan, and there is a vast difference between the Jordan and the fiery brook. That is the telling difference which separates conservatives from neoconservatives. It has always struck me as an odd and even perverse that former Marxists have been permitted, yes, invited to play such a leading role in the conservative movement in the 20th century. It is splendid when the town whore gets religion and joins the church. Now and then they make good choir directors. But when she begins to tell the minister what he ought to say in his Sunday sermons, matters have been carried too far. Conservatism has had some strange camp followers in these last 30 years. I once remarked to Glenn Campbell that had Stalin spared Leon Trotsky and not had him murdered in Mexico by Frank Jackson, he would no doubt have spent his declining days in an office in the Hoover Library writing memoirs and contributing articles of a faintly neoconservative flavor for Encounter magazine and commentary. Is it ungracious of me to suggest that political and even religious conversion does not often improve the mind's capacity for sound judgment? Whitaker Chambers, whom I find one of the most beguiling intellectuals of the 20th century, had a flawed judgment. He had a flawed judgment as a Marxist, and he said some very silly things on the subject of conservatism when he became a convert. All of which is not to say that the rejection of Marxism is unimportant and that the piecemeal rejection of various articles of faith shared with left liberal modernists is unimportant, nor do I wish to imply that the assistance of neoconservatives is unwelcome in the work of dismantling the failed political structures erected by modernity. Conservatives have made common cause with classical liberals, and there is no reason why they should not make common cause with neoconservatives. When the wagon train is attacked, we arm the women and the children, even though they may, in their ineptitude, occasionally mistake a friend for the foe. Still, halfway from modernity is not far enough. Politics has always been inseparable from culture, and both derive ultimately from religion. It is absurd to believe that one can remain a modernist in culture and reject the implications of modernism in politics. Unbelief is incompatible with conservatism. Conserve what? And to what end? Werner Danhauser, writing in the December 1985 number of Commentary, tells us, and I quote, "Too many conservatives have failed to come to terms with Nietzsche's thought, thank God, dismissing it as an embarrassing attempt to outflank them on the right. But the challenge he represents will not go away." Danhauser continues, "Nietzsche went far beyond Berg, who held out the hope of a time when atheism might cease to be fashionable. Nietzsche postulated an irreversible loss of naivete in Western civilization. To put the matter crudely, he argued that the cat of atheism was out of the bag. The meanest capacities could learn that religion was a myth, and when a myth is exposed for what it is, it can no longer serve to provide a unified horizon." Danhauser continues further, "Too many conservatives whose own belief is weak and non-existent, who will privately admit that religion is for the troops, continue to try to teach the catechism to those troops, forgetting that the latter have by now been thoroughly exposed to the Enlightenment and its lessons." There you have it. The dividing line between conservatives and neoconservatives is the line separating Burke from Nietzsche. Let me say parenthetically that I could never understand the reasoning processes and I came even to doubt the ability of these men to read the reasoning processes of Jews who are Nietzscheans. Walter Kaufmann, who was, on the whole, both more honest and more sophisticated than Danhauser, was quite unable to discern that while Nietzsche was not a biological racist, he was a philosophical anti-Semite. If Nietzsche's anti-Semitism was less vulgar than that of Julius Streicher, or of Nietzsche's friend Richard Wagner, it was no less deadly. One is struck again by the true and forceful portrait Thomas Mann gives us of the Nietzschean modernist in the person of Adrian Leverkuhn in Mann's great novel, Dr. Faustus. Adrian's music is modernist music. Adrian is a composer. Not only as a musical style, but in terms of the metaphysical conception out of which the music is constructed. It is also demonic music. It can only come into existence through the ruin of a soul, the destruction of a mind, and as the work of the composer reaches fruition, Germany is destroyed philosophically and sinks into ruin beneath the rain of Allied bombs. Mann, who made the character of Adrian Leverkuhn of a composite of Nietzsche and Arnold Schoenberg, intended in this, the greatest novel, I think, of the 20th century, to tell us something about the cultural reality of our age. The narrator, Serena Zeitblom, is a religious and pious conservative, one, I take it, who had missed the Enlightenment of which Danhauser is so fond. I sometimes imagine myself and my fellow conservatives to be of the type of Serena Zeitblom. We have a loving regard for our age and our fellow men, and we realize that we must often forego intervention and permit the tragic drama to play itself out. Because Adrian Leverkuhn could not accept an order which, modernist that he was, he felt to be meaningless, he imposed a new order, rational and cleanly articulated as the music of Bach, but lacking Bach's attachment to the divine and reconciliation to the human. Leverkuhn's achievement was a great technical triumph, but only a triumph of technique. It is fitting funeral music for a culture which died of pride. Rational technique in the pursuit of irrational ends, that suggests the modernist condition. That is why neoconservatives are so inventive and often correct in dealing with the realm of technique. But when push comes to shove, as it always does in society and culture, ends are of ultimate importance and will finally determine the appropriate technique. What the neoconservatives have done is to divorce techniques from ends in an effort to maintain their cultural modernism while rejecting its social and political implications. This, I say, is quite impossible and in the long run dangerous. It is easy to see that the utopian social and political programs of the last 100 years have failed. It is not the cat of atheism that has been let out of the bag, but the failure of the Enlightenment in all its forms. Neoconservatives are, as Irving Kristol remarked, liberals who have been mugged by reality. But while they have been detached from their social and political myths, they have not located themselves in a body of principle which makes life worth living or that one would die defending. Much as I admire the views of Irving Kristol, which I find regularly propounded in the Wall Street Journal, I would not, to quote Whitaker Chambers, storm up a beach defending those views. It is important to remember that neoconservatism is made up of those liberals who were mugged by reality, though that phrase is only a part of the truth about neoconservatism. It is above all a transmogrification of what has been called the New York intellectuals. The New York intellectuals, in turn, were a reflection of the instantiation of modernity among secularized Jewish intellectuals. Neoconservatism is culturally unthinkable aside from the history of the Jewish intellectual in America in the 20th century. When the New York intellectuals turned from the beguilements of left-wing revolutionary utopianism, they did not, in fact, become conservatives, but attached themselves to positions which were neoliberal, in the sense that Mises and von Hayek were neoliberals. And just as Mises and von Hayek are, above all, philosophical and cultural modernists, so too New York intellectuals who now call themselves neoconservatives are modernists. Conservatism has its roots in a much older tradition. It's a worldview which is essentially Roman and Anglo-Catholic. Its political philosophy is Aristotelian and Thomist. Its concerns, moral and ethical. Its culture, that of Christian humanism. Most old-fashioned conservatives are free of metaphysical anxiety and as happy as clams in a world which bears the unmistakable imprint of God's ordering hand. They are free of alienation. I've got the message, but I've got another that I'm going to complete. Thank you. They believe that human institutions and human culture are subject to the judgment of God, and they hold that the most effective political instrument is prayer and a commitment to try and understand and do the will of God. If neoconservatives wish us to take their conservatism seriously, they must return to their religious roots, the religious roots, beliefs, and values of our common heritage. They cannot dither in the halfway house of modernity and offer us technical solutions which touch the symptoms, but which never deal with the causes of contemporary disorder.